Numbers 10:11 through 11:3, the first talk in a series on the narrative portions of Numbers, was presented by David Crabtree on October 24, 2004 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I had a cold this last week. Yesterday I spoke at Oktoberfest, and when I got to the end of my talk, my voice ran out. So my strategy today is to talk faster. I'm hoping I'll get done before my voice runs out. We're going to be looking at Numbers. I have told several people recently that we were going to be looking at Numbers, and the response was uniform. Numbers? It is part of the Bible. So I decided I'm not going to take very much time, but I am going to give a short apologia for why teach Numbers. First of all, why teach the Old Testament? It is my perspective that the Old Testament is undervalued in our Christian culture. That it's, although it's part of our Bible, it's a neglected part of our Bible. And that's unfortunate. On Tuesday nights, Jack's been teaching through Romans, and I've been following along. And it has struck me once again the extent to which Romans was written by Paul, assuming that his audience knew a lot about the Old Testament and the Jewish traditions. And the New Testament in general, I would say, is a very Jewish book that is anchored in the Old Testament. And if we don't know the Old Testament, we aren't going to be able to understand the New Testament well. Why Numbers? Well, the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, are considered by Jewish tradition to be the heart of the Old Testament. That's really the essence of what God has to say to mankind. And Numbers is a part of that story. The Pentateuch starts with the creation, the beginning of the world, and it takes us through the time when the people of Israel are on the doorstep of entering into the promised land. And much happens in that journey, and that's really the foundations on which Judaism and the religion that God gave Israel is founded. And Numbers plays an integral part in that, and therefore I think it's worth looking at. I am just going to be looking at the historical narrative portions. As I did in Exodus, I'm going to do the same thing in Numbers. I would someday like to come back and do the law portions of the Torah, but I need to get wiser and more skilled before I inflict that upon you and upon me. Okay, so what is Numbers? Numbers is the fourth book of the Pentateuch. The name Numbers comes from the Septuagint version, in which it was titled Arithmoi, which means numbers. Apparently that came from the fact that the account begins with a census. A census is taken of all of the people of Israel. The Jewish name for the book, as is typical in Jewish tradition, it comes from the first word in the book, and that's Vadeber. But that name is not used commonly for Numbers because there is another book that begins with the same word, so there's confusion. So in Jewish tradition, this is referred to as In the Wilderness, Bamidbar, which is very appropriate because Numbers talks about the events that occur between the time when the Jews receive the law in Mount Sinai and their march from there to the doorstep of Canaan. In Numbers, we have a combination of law and historical narrative. As I said, I'm just going to focus on the historical narrative, So we are going to skip the first 10 chapters and start in the middle chapter, in chapter 10. What happens in the first 10 chapters? First of all, a census is taken. And historically, in the history of Israel, a census is taken before and after a war. So you take a census before you levy your armies. And then you take a census after the war is completed. And apparently then, the implications of that then is that from the time that the Jews leave Mount Sinai, they are on a military footing. This is war. Then in Numbers we have a few chapters in which additional laws are given. And we have a description of the second Passover. The first Passover was celebrated while they were still in Egypt. The second Passover is celebrated in the early part of Numbers, so that means 1 year has passed, and which I think is significant. We'll see a little bit more of that in a second. So we'll start in Numbers, chapter 10, verse 11. I'll read the first through verse 28. Now it came about in the second year, the second month, on the 20th of the month, that the cloud was lifted from over the tabernacle of the testimony. And the sons of Israel set out on their journeys from the wilderness of Sinai. Then the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. So they moved out for the first time according to the commandment of the Lord through Moses. And the standard of the camp of the sons of Judah, according to their armies, set out first, with Nashon, the son of Amminadab, over its army, and Nethanel, the son of Zuar, over the tribal army of the sons of Issachar, and Eliab, the son of Helon, over the tribal army of the sons of Zebulun. Then the tabernacle was taken down, and the sons of Gershon and the sons of Merari, who were carrying the tabernacle, set out. And the standard of the camp of Reuben, according to their armies, set out with Eleazar, the son of Shedur, over its army. And Shemuliel, the son of Zurishaddai, over the tribal army of the sons of Simeon. And Eliasaph, the son of Deuel, was over the tribal army of the sons of Gad. Then the Kohathites set out, carrying the holy objects, and the tabernacle was set up before their arrival. Next, the standard of the camp of the sons of Ephraim, according to their armies, was set out, with Elishama, the son of Amahud, over its army, and Gamaliel, the son of Pedazur, over the tribal army of sons of Manasseh, and Abadon, the son of Gideoni, over the tribal army of the sons of Benjamin. And the standards of the camp of the sons of Dan, according to their armies, which formed the rear guard for all the camps, set out with Eleazar, the son of Amishaddai, over its army, and Pagiel, the son of Achran, over the tribal army of the sons of Asher, and Ahira, the son of Enan, over the tribal army of the sons of Naphtali. This was the order of march of the sons of Israel by their armies as they set out. Okay, so it's the beginning, it's the second month of the second year on the 20th day of the, let's see, on the 20th day of the month that they are setting out from Mount Sinai. So that means, this is all dated from the Exodus. So they have been out of Egypt for just, what's that, 14 months, almost 15 months? They went from Egypt through part of the Sinai, made their way to Mount Sinai, where they received the law, and they camped there for a number of months. I don't remember how many months, but I think it was about 9 months that they camped there. And now they're starting to head out from there. It says that the cloud was lifted from over the tabernacle of the testimony. The tabernacle is the tent, the portable temple that was built according to the instructions that were given by God at Sinai. So they built that, and they have this portable temple that they pack up when they're ready to leave, and then they set up whenever they arrive at a stopping point. And God's pattern was, as right from the beginning, when they left Egypt, they were led by this cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. And this cloud, whenever they are stopped someplace and they've set up the tabernacle, the cloud settles down over the tabernacle. And when it's time to leave, apparently the cloud rises up and moves to the fore of the people of the camp, and then it moves on and they follow it. When they arrive where they're supposed to stop, apparently it stops. They hurry and rush in and assemble the tabernacle, and a cloud settles down on the tabernacle then, and they camp there. So the cloud has risen up. It's time for them to go. Now this section is talking about the trip. It says their journeys from the wilderness of Sinai. And the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. They don't get to Paran, if we follow the account, they don't get to Paran until the end of chapter 12. So this section from the middle of 10 to the end of 12 is all a unit. This is the beginning of this unit that's talking about this leg of the journey. They moved out for the first time according to the commandment of the Lord through Moses. Now it's not clear what this means, how Moses gave this command. But it is interesting to note that although the cloud rises up and indicates that it's time to go, the people don't set out until they receive the word from Moses. And we'll see this pattern consistently through the text, that Moses is really their leader. He's receiving his instructions from God, but he is the one who is actually the hands-on leader, and the people respond to his instructions. And that's the way it's intended to be. How does he give the command? It doesn't say, but in the first part of 10, part that we're skipping, God instructed them to make these trumpets out of metal, two trumpets, and those trumpets are to be used as a commanding device. They blow on the trumpets, and that's the way the people get their commands. So presumably, he is using the trumpets that were just made in the first part of the chapter in order to convey this command to the people. Now, I'm going to digress a little bit here. To make a point that I have made before, but I think it's worth making again. In the commentaries on the trumpets, it's interesting because there are two words used for trumpets. One is a metal trumpet, and the other one is a horn, which is literally made out of the horn of a goat or something. And they blow through that horn and make a trumpeting sound. There's a different word for each of those kinds of trumpet, and those are used throughout the Old Testament. Since the early 1900s in biblical studies, it has been, especially Old Testament studies, it has been common to view the Old Testament as this document that came into being late, long after the events that it is pretending to describe, as they would think about it. And that someone at this late date took various traditions and rather haphazardly pasted them together. And it's our job as biblical scholars to recognize where the different traditions are, where one tradition fills in a passage and where another passage is from some other tradition. And you go through the Bible, the Old Testament, just finding where passages must have come from different traditions. As a result, people have seen these two words for trumpets And the assumption has been, the consensus is that the horn that's made out of a goat's horn is the older word. And wherever you see that, it indicates that this passage came from the older tradition. Wherever you see the word for a metal horn, that's more recent, and that means that that comes from a more recent tradition. If one takes that approach, one is only going to find in the text, they're just going to find pieces. One is never going to see the whole text and take the whole text seriously. It's inevitable. But it is very interesting to me that in recent times, and I would say particularly in Jewish academia, there are Jews that are saying, well, you know, if you look at these books, they have a lot of coherence. They have a lot more coherence than you would expect to find if someone just haphazardly pasted together bits and pieces from different inconsistent traditions. So someone must have put these together while their brain was actually operating. They're actually thinking about what they're doing. And they have a reason why they put these all together. Let's approach the book with that assumption, that whoever wrote it, they knew what they were doing. And I have heavily used, both in Genesis, Exodus, and now in Numbers, commentaries that were produced by Jewish scholars. And the one that I'm using for Numbers is one that was created by a professor who teaches in I don't know if they call him professors or not. He teaches in a yeshiva, and he's been teaching Numbers for a number of years. And this commentary is a result of his students' observations, his observations and his students' observations as they have worked through Numbers over the last several years. It draws a lot upon rabbinic sources and their observations, and it is fascinating. They have observed a lot of very interesting things. It sounds like they conduct their classes a lot like we do our discussions at Gutenberg. So he's put together this commentary that is based on those discussions. And he has observed that whenever the word horn of a goat is used, that the horn is being blown by a layman. If it's a metal horn, it's being blown by a priest. So the distinction is not antiquity, and the distinction is not what does the horn, what is it being used to communicate, it's rather who is communicating it. Now, whether that's right or not, I find it fascinating, because if you look at the text as a coherent whole, it is possible to find consistencies that you will never find if you're looking at it as a bunch of fragments that were just haphazardly put together. And I have seen that consistently. And I side with the ones who see it as a coherent whole. I mean, it makes a lot more sense to give the text the benefit of the doubt. Let's see if it can make sense. Let's do the extra effort to see if we can find a consistency where there doesn't appear to be a consistency. Okay, he gives them the order of the march. Notice, I'm not going to go through the order of the march. I can't even pronounce the names of the people in the order of the march. But Judah is going first, and we have observed in Genesis that the firstborn and the secondborn to Jacob, both in one way or another disqualified themselves to be the inheritors. And Judah, the thirdborn, acted nobly and admirably as we get to the end of Genesis. And so notice here that Judah is the tribe that initiates the march. Next section, 29-32. Then Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, We are setting out to the place of which the Lord said, I will give it to you. Come with us, and we will do you good, for the Lord has promised good concerning Israel. But he said to him, I will not come, but rather I will go down to my own land and relatives. Then he said, please do not leave us, inasmuch as you know where we should camp in the wilderness, and you will be as eyes for us. So it will be, if you will go with us, it will come about that whatever good the Lord does for us, we will do for you. This is an interesting and very cryptic account. Moses is talking to Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law. The Hebrew text is ambiguous whether father-in-law refers to Reuel or to Hobab. Now, there are three names that are used and referred to as Moses' father-in-law. Jethro, Reuel, and Hobab, all potentially. So the question is, what's going on here? How can he have three fathers-in-law? Now, you recall that how did Moses get a father-in-law in the first place? Moses fled from Egypt long before the Exodus, fled from Egypt, went into the desert, and allied himself with this group of Midianites, and was a shepherd in the desert, and ended up marrying one of them, Zipporah, I believe. And so his father-in-law then would be one of the Midianites. Now, how can we have three names for a father-in-law? And there are a number of solutions that have been proposed to this, and I won't go through all of them, but one that seems plausible is that Reuel and Jethro are two different names for the same person. That's not unheard of. We've seen that in Genesis, where Jacob has two names, Jacob and Israel, and we have other Old Testament characters that have two names. So here I think that's very plausible that there are two different names for the same person. For Hobab, the word that is translated father-in-law, apparently there's reason to believe that it could mean not just father-in-law, but relative of the bride. So usually it's father-in-law in most cases in which we see it, but apparently it can mean brother-in-law, and that might be the case here. Another complication is Hobab is sometimes referred to as a Midianite and sometimes as a Kenite. And all of these discrepancies are things that those who see the Bible, the Old Testament, as coming from different sources use as indicators that we have different traditions here. But there are indications that the term Midianite is referring to a tribal group, and Kenite is referring to a clan within the tribe. So one is just a larger group, of which Kenites are a subdivision. And I think that makes good sense. In any case, I think that this is resolvable, and it appears to be that Hobab is, my best guess is that he's brother-in-law then of Moses. In any case, Moses addresses him and he says, come with us the rest of the way. We are going to the place that God is sending us to, and come with us and we will do you good, for the Lord has promised good concerning Israel. So he's saying, come along with us, this place that God is showing us, and you will receive blessing along with us. And Hobab says, no, it's time for me to go home. I'm going to go back home. And Moses appeals to him again and makes it a little more forceful. And says, please do not leave us, inasmuch as you know where we should camp in the wilderness, and you will be as eyes for us. In other words, Moses is imploring him, Hobab knows life in the desert, and he wants to draw upon that. Now, where you know where we should camp, this is a little mysterious because God seems to be indicating where they're going to stop. Now, I don't know if there's a certain amount of latitude in where that is, whether they can move half a mile to the right or what exactly is going on here. But apparently Hobab knows life in the wilderness, in the desert, and that knowledge can be really helpful with respect to camping. He also says, and you will be as eyes for us. Now that could be as a guide, but again, they have the pillar to lead them. But it could be speaking a little more broadly. Now, I'll talk about this later, but I think it's possible he's talking about not eyes as far as being a guide, but rather eyes as far as being an advisor. And that he's asking Hobab to serve in the capacity as an advisor to Moses. But we'll see that in just a little bit. What's interesting here is what Moses is saying to Hobab is, promises have been made to us as a people, as Jews. You are not a Jew, but come join us, and you can benefit from the promises that have been made to us. So a non-Jew that's being asked to accept the promises of God that have been made to Israel, and he will benefit secondarily from those same promises. He's asking Hobab to have faith. Faith in those promises. How does Hobab respond? The text doesn't say. You gotta love the Old Testament authors. The information that you would like to have, expect to have, is oftentimes not there. That's not the point that he's emphasizing. He's got another point that he's making here, the author does. There are indications, however, when the Israelites go into the promised land, that the Kenites are among them. They are part of the people that move into the promised land. So presumably, Hobab says yes. Hobab joins them. Next section, 33 through 36. Thus they set out from the mount of the Lord 3 days' journey, with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord journeying in front of them for 3 days, to seek out a resting place for them. And the cloud of the Lord was over them by day, and when they set out from the camp. Then it came about when the ark set out that Moses said, Rise up, O Lord, and let thine enemies be scattered, and let those who hate thee flee before thee. And when it came to rest, he said, Return thou, O Lord, to the myriad thousands of Israel. So they take off from Mount Sinai. They go 3 days' journey, and then before they come to a stop. So this is kind of a forced march. It's 3 days in a row of marching. That's faster than they ever marched in the first part of the journey on the way from Egypt to Mount Sinai. So it's a forced march. Some Jewish rabbis ventured an explanation for this forced march. They said they wanted to get away from Sinai because they didn't want to receive any more laws. In any case, this is going quite rapidly, and more rapidly than they're used to doing. This section from 35 to 36 is set off in the Hebrew text with what are called inverted nouns. It's like an N turned upside down. Does that help in English? It's an N that has been flipped over, that comes before it and comes after it. And they don't know exactly what that means. But it occurs elsewhere in the Old Testament. And the assumption is that someone very early thought that this part of the text may not belong here. What it says here, these words all appear in Psalms, where they are not set off by inverted nouns. So I'm not going to go into this, but it's just talking about what is said when they get ready to leave, and then when they stop. Okay, moving on. Chapter 11. Let's do 1 through 1-4. Now the people became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. The people therefore cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died out. So the name of that place was called Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burned among them. What we're going to see now is on this leg of the trip that goes from Sinai to Paran, they have three stopping points, at least that are listed, and at each of those three stopping points, the Jews register some complaint. The Israelites register some kind of complaint. This is the first of them. And in this case, it's not clear what they're complaining about. It just says that they became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord. So it's not clear what they're complaining about. It could be the forced march. It could be that they've had to march hard for 3 days in a row. Another possibility is that they're running out of water. That was a problem that occurred in the first part of their trip from Egypt to Sinai. In any case, the author isn't telling us. All he's telling us is that they began to complain, and they began to complain brazenly. It's as if they're going directly before God and complaining to him. God's response, God is angry. And unlike, and we'll talk about the comparisons between the complaints here and the complaints that occur in the early part of their trip, but God responds immediately. And it says that the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. So God acts quickly and acts punitively. And some of them are destroyed by a fire. Now, it's not clear what kind of fire. I don't know whether it's lightning or whether it's something else. But God is acting. And it's on the outskirts of the camp. Now, the outskirts of the camp could be significant, as we'll see in the next time of people complaining, that it talks about the rabble. It could be that this is all a reference to non-Jews that were traveling with the children of Abraham. The children of Abraham are all assigned their spots whenever they camp. There's a particular location that they're supposed to be in. And when it says the outskirts of the camp, that could be the area outside of the camp proper. And it's possible that that's the area that's assigned to those who had come along, who were not Jews, who were not Israelites, who came along out of Egypt. If that's true, then, that's interesting. It's possible, then, that some of the complaining started from there. We'll see, however, that it is abundantly clear that if that's the case, it's not they alone that are complaining. The Israelites are complaining as well. In any case, the people cry out to Moses and ask him to pray to the Lord, which he does, and the fire is stopped. Once again, we have Moses as the one who is the conduit for communication, both from the people to God and from God to the people. Both ways, Moses plays the role of the conduit for that communication. Next section. And the rabble who were among them had greedy desires, and also the sons of Israel wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic, but now our appetite is gone. There is nothing at all to look at except this manna." Now the manna was like coriander seed, and its appearance like that of delium. The people would go about and gather it and grind it between two stones or beat it in mortar and boil it in the pot and make cakes with it. And its taste was as the taste of cakes baked with oil. And when the dew fell on the camp at night, the manna would fall with it. I love this section. I can identify with it so well. The rabble, and again, this word only occurs here. And it's possible that this means the non-Israelites, because then it goes on to say, and also the sons of Israel wept again. So it's possible that the complaining started among the non-Israelites, but it definitely spreads throughout the camp. What are they weeping about? They're saying, who will give us meat to eat? And they go on to say, remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers and the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. Their complaint is, all they got to eat is manna. They're tired of tuna casserole. It's just the same old thing every day. Why can't we have what we had back in Egypt? There we had fish. We haven't seen a fish in over a year. And I can just taste it in my mouth. It's so good. And we don't have that. It is intolerable, the conditions that we're in now. They say, now our appetite is gone. And there is nothing to look at except this manna. They're wasting away. It's a wonderful complaint. It's a complaint of spoiled children. And it's a complaint that I know I'm guilty of. I suspect that we're all guilty of it. It's not that they're really in trouble. It's that they're tired of eating manna. The next section is interesting because it goes on to talk about this manna. And manna is a rather versatile food. It can be prepared in a lot of different ways. It's good. It's easy to collect. It comes miraculously from the heavens. And yet they're dissatisfied with this because it's boring. They want fish. They want cucumbers. They want melons. And notice what they say. We used to eat free in Egypt. They've forgotten that in Egypt they were slaves. They've forgotten the very thing that God accomplished by bringing them out of Egypt. And they don't value that. They take it for granted now. It's only taken 13 months. They've got memories like I do. The response. The next section. Now Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families, each man at the doorway of his tent. And the anger of the Lord was kindled greatly, and Moses was displeased. So Moses said to the Lord, why hast thou been so hard on thy servant? And why have I not found favor in thy sight, that thou hast laid the burden of all this people on me? Was it I who conceived all this people? Was it I who brought them forth, that thou shouldst say to me, carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a nursing infant, to the land which thou didst swear to their fathers? Where am I to get meat to give to all this people? For they weep before me, saying, give us meat that we may eat. I alone am not able to carry all this people, because it is too burdensome for me. So if thou art going to deal thus with me, please kill me at once. If I have found favor in thy sight, and do not let me see my wretchedness. This is very interesting. This is not the way that Moses has responded in the past. Well, let me go. Let's look back at what happened in Exodus. This is in chapter, I think it's chapters 15 through 18 in Exodus. It's talking about that first leg of their journey from Egypt to Mount Sinai. And what's interesting is there too we have three incidents of complaint. And then that's followed by the incident in which Jethro, his father-in-law, comes to Moses and says, you know, this is too hard for one person. you should select some people to help you to rule over the people. Then we have what happens in Sinai and the law being given in Sinai. Now we're starting out again. The first thing that the text talks about is Moses talking to Hobab, which is followed by three incidents of complaint on the part of the Israelites. Now, one thing that the Jewish commentary has focused on that I have undervalued is the structure of the narrative. But the structure of the narrative is very purposeful. And when you see those kinds of patterns, you need to pay attention to them. That the author is encouraging us to compare the incidents that happened in Exodus, where there are the three complaints followed by the advice from Jethro. He's encouraging us to compare that with this that we find in Numbers, where we have the advice from, we have the incident with Hobab and then the three complaints. The author is consciously encouraging us to compare those two sections of text. So let's do so. Those three complaints on the way from Egypt to Sinai are the following. The first was they had been marching through the desert. They arrive at Marah, where finally they reach water, but the water is undrinkable. And the people complain to Moses, and they say, "You just brought us out to the desert to die." And so Moses appeals to God, and God shows him a tree that he throws into the water, and the water turns sweet, and they all drink. Then it says in the next verse, their next stop, they stopped at a place with 12 springs. So God provided for them very generously. The next event, the next complaint is, we have no food. And what does God do? He responds by sending manna out of heaven. And they are able to eat as much as they want. They are able to eat plenty, and God provides for them miraculously. Not only does he provide the manna, but he provides quail. They can just go and pick up quail off the ground, and that's provided by God as well. So God responds very, very graciously to both of those complaints. Then the third incident. I need to refresh my memory. Once again, no water. And Moses, that's the time that Moses, the people became very upset with Moses. And Moses says, "What shall I do with this people? A little more, and they will stone me." But God directs Moses to hit the rock with, use his staff to hit the rock, and water comes out of the rock, and the people are once again provided for. In all of those cases, there is genuine need on the part of the people. By all appearances, it looks like there is genuine need. They appeal to Moses, and Moses is very empathetic. Moses realizes that there is genuine need, and he appeals to God on their behalf. And in each case, God is very generous. God is very merciful, and he grants them what they are calling for. This case is different. In both of these instances, there's no indication that the need is genuine. They could live the way things are going. The problem is they want something just things aren't the way they would like them to be. And Moses' response here is, "I've had it. I didn't bring this people into being. I mean, you did, God. They're your people. Why do I have to be saddled with them? Why do I have to endure this? And besides, Where am I going to get meat? What's interesting here is this is very unlike his responses before. What's happening? Moses is tired. Moses is just worn down, I think. And in this state, he's losing track. He's losing perspective. He's forgotten that God is the one who's been providing all along. God is the one for whom ultimately responsibility for these people rests. Moses is just his appointed leader. He's just carrying out God's instructions. He doesn't have to shoulder this burden by himself. So let's look at God's response to this. God responds very mercifully, it seems to me. 16 through 23. The Lord therefore said to Moses, "Gather for me 70 men from the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people and their officers, and bring them to the tent of meeting, and let them take their stand there with you. Then I will come down and speak with you there, and I will take of the Spirit who is upon you, and will put him upon them. And they shall bear the burden of the people with you, so that you shall not bear it all alone. And say to the people, 'Consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the ears of the Lord, saying, "Oh, that someone would give us meat to eat, for we were well off in Egypt." Therefore, the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall eat not one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, but a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wept before him, saying, "Why did we ever leave Egypt?" But Moses said, "The people among whom I am are 600,000 on foot, yet thou hast said, 'I will give them meat in order that they may eat for a whole month.' Should flocks and herds be slaughtered for them to be sufficient for them? Or should all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them to be sufficient for them?" And the Lord said to Moses, "Is the Lord's power limited? Now you shall see whether my word will come true for you or not." Next week, I'm going to talk about the other half of this, and I want to talk about how God is dealing with the people. But focusing this week just on how he's dealing with Moses, it seems to me this is very gracious. He realizes that what Moses is expressing is fatigue, not rebellion. He realizes that what's happened here is Moses is just worn down. So how does he respond to it? He says, first of all, let's spread the burden. As happened before Sinai, according to Jethro's suggestion, in which a similar kind of thing was done. And what happened in the interim? Did that system break down, or is this in addition to that? I don't know. But God wants to spread the burden around. He wants to allow more people to be involved in this and take some of the load off of Moses' shoulders. The other thing that he's going to do is he's going to provide meat. They wanted it. They're going to get it. And we'll see how they're going to get it and what the ramifications of that are later. But Moses' response to that is, where am I going to get all that meat? Which is an incredible response. I mean, Moses has really lost perspective here. Because Moses hasn't provided anything all the way along. All of the other instances where there were complaints, Moses didn't provide nothing. It was God who came through. And he's forgotten. He's seeing this as all on his shoulders. He's got to come up with this meat that God is promising. Does God punish him for that? No, in this instance, what God says is, just wait and see. Am I limited? Do you think I can't do it? Let's see what happens. Okay, we'll stop there for today, and I want to finish up this incident of complaint and talk about God's response to the people. But I find this very refreshing and reassuring. Moses too is human. I mean, there are a few characters in the Old Testament that my tendency is to see them as such paragons of faith and virtue that they would never falter. But the biblical text is quite clear. They all do. I mean, if we're looking carefully, objectively, they all do. And here is an instance in which Moses has faltered. He has lost perspective. There are things that he knows better that he's lost track of. And you think about what God has done through Moses, the incredible things that Moses has personally witnessed God doing. And it's easy to say, how could he possibly lose perspective to that extent? But we all do. It only takes a few days for something that God has done that's truly, truly a wonder to start to think, well, it wasn't all that great. The parting of the Red Sea, well, yeah, that's kind of a big deal, but it's not that big deal. We all do that. And I'm sure that Moses has done that. And it's just the everyday, the trials of the everyday wear a person down. And that's what's happened here. And God's response is graciousness. It's just kind of gently coming alongside and saying, well, settle down, Moses. We'll take care of this one step at a time, and we'll get you back on your feet. I know that God has done that with me a number of times, and I hope that he will continue to be gracious towards me and do that sort of thing again. Okay, questions or comments?
It seems like part of what wore Moses down was the complaints of all the people.
Yes.
That he was the conduit. And then part of what God responded to was actually spreading that responsibility out so that Moses wouldn't hear all the complaints, that there's these other 70 men who'd hear parts of the complaint.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's interesting. It's very true that it's those complaints that obviously wear Moses down. And you can see in Moses, especially in Exodus, whenever they complain, I think Moses is very aware of how God would look at their complaining, its faithlessness. But on the other hand, he's empathetic with the people. So he's in this tough situation where he's caught in between. And when he's continually hearing these complaints, he feels that day by day by day, and that's what's wearing him down. Yeah.
And we all know what it's like to have people complain.
Yeah.
It's very wearing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's easy for it's easy to get in a group of people, any group of people, it's easy to get complaining going, and it can pick up momentum quite rapidly.
You made the comment of God responding mercifully here. What about the part about that the food will become loathsome?
Well, I'm talking about his response to Moses.
Yeah. What do you see in that part there, though?
Well, we'll talk about that next week, but I would say there's even some mercy in that, but it's a different kind of mercy. But we'll talk about that next week. Okay. Thanks.